Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
It is Legal Face Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. Lots to get to today. Rich Linkoff in the house and David Sussler sitting in for Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich. We begin with our SCOTUS panel. It's a very Supreme Court heavy show. Carolyn Shapiro, Associate Professor of Law at Chicago Kent College of Law. She's also the co-director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States. And Andy DeVote, partner at Loeb & Loeb. They've both been on the show multiple times. And we welcome you both back to Legal Face Off. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, both former Supreme Court clerks. This is one of our favorite episodes of the year because we get to break down some breaking news involving the Supreme Court. The term just ended. Obviously, one of the most important stories is Justice Kennedy announcing his retirement. We will get to that in a minute. But let's jump into a couple of the key cases. We're covering a couple of the other ones in detail with some guests shortly. But let's talk first about the case that got lots of attention, Trump versus Hawaii, also known as the Trump travel ban case. Carolyn, explain to our listeners what that case was all about, please.
So shortly after the president came into office, he issued what was known as the travel ban or the Muslim ban, which was a ban on travelers entering the United States from a number of different majority Muslim countries. It was implemented. It was this first executive order was caused a lot of chaos. It wasn't very well thought out. There was no implementation plan that people may remember. That's when there were all the demonstrations at the airports. It was stayed by the courts pretty quickly. The president then issued a second version, also stayed by the courts, and eventually issued a third version, which is the one that's now at issue. It's a narrower version of the ban. It is about seven countries that are on the list, all majority Muslim, except for some additional restrictions on particular people from North Korea and Venezuela. And the justification for the ban is that those countries don't share enough information, or at least that's the purported justification, is that those countries don't share enough information with us to properly vet the people who might be coming from there for safety before they arrive in the United States. The Supreme Court upheld that against two challenges. One was a challenge that the statute that gives the president authority to restrict who could come in didn't actually give him this much authority. And the court nobody seemed to think otherwise. There were even the dissenters didn't take issue with that in fact it does give him that authority. But the other challenge was that this was motivated by an anti-Muslim bias. On that point, there were five justices who said it really didn't matter what was in the president's head or in his tweets, because the administration had provided a rational basis, which was this vetting concern.
So lots of people, Andy, obviously unhappy with that logic. Justice Sotomayor wrote a very impassioned dissent that was joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, talking about how actually she referenced the 1945 decision in Korematsu, in which the court upheld internment camps during World War II. What are your thoughts on that dissent and public sentiment as a result of this decision?
Yeah, I think Carolyn's description was spot on. And, in terms of the dissent, it raises sort of two interesting points. One, in the context of Korematsu, that's a decision that is chilling to everyone. And I think it's, this idea that one always has to be cognizant of the decisions and actions that are taking place under the guise of national security interests. And I think that, it's patriotic to always continue to challenge ourselves. When we use that label, does it justify this action? Is that where, there was some stat about that none of the terror attacks in our country since 9/11 would have actually been prevented by this travel ban. In terms of, the comments about the president, it raises such an interesting point because with technology, I know we're going to talk about other cases, this notion of what someone says on Twitter or someone says in campaign speeches, in a lot of cases, you don't have direct evidence of what someone is thinking. And here, the argument is that you do have this direct evidence that you have this animus. And Justice Sotomayor said, look, in a decision decided earlier this month that was Masterpiece Cake Shop, which you all remember was the decision out of Colorado involving the man who didn't want to make a cake, Justice Kennedy in particular Carolyn and I talked about this in another program, you know, was very bothered by what he thought was animus towards a particular religion and the gentleman's religious beliefs. And I think that Justice Sotomayor made the point that, you know, here we have statements seemingly reflecting similar animus, but we don't have the same result. So I think it's an interesting observation. You know, I think a lot of people found it to be a powerful dissent.
All right, let's turn to another case, Carpenter versus United States. Andy, can you give us the rundown on that one, and then we'll turn to Carolyn for why it was significant.
Sure. So this is an interesting case because, again, you're talking about law and technology, and I think I've said to you before in this program that one of my favorite con law professors said that, you know, it's sort of like your grandparents. The Supreme Court is your grandparents deciding constitutional law. And although the court is actually a little younger, that definitely was true for a long time. And so you have this intersection of, you know, our heavy, heavy reliance on our cell phones, right? Everyone has their cell phones, their cell phone with them almost at all times. And this was a question of whether or not cell site data was data that could be obtained from a cell phone company, from an individual's phone, Mr. Carpenter, without a search warrant. And specifically, guys, this type of data, I can tell you from being a prosecutor, is really persuasive because you can the phone pings off a tower. And when it pings off that tower, it puts you in a certain location. And then in this instance, Timothy Carpenter, it put his phone, they got info over a 7-day period of time, within the vicinity of robberies. And he ended up being convicted with this powerful evidence. And I think he was sentenced to something equivalent to over 100 years in prison for these different robberies. The question was whether or not they have to have a search warrant for this. And in this instance, five justices, with Chief Justice Roberts writing the opinion, said that in this instance, they did need a search warrant. And it was trying to reconcile a doctrine called the third party doctrine. Because when you think about it, guys, the Constitution is designed what the government can and can't do. But there's always been this idea of, well, if third parties, if private actors, non-government actors have your information and you knowingly give it to them, then that information can be obtained from the third party. And Chief Justice Roberts said in this instance, you know, again, relying on the evolution of technology and the fact that we have our cell phones with us at all times, there's this notion, this particular instance, he thought that the five justices thought that, you know, you did have to have a search warrant. The dissenters, Justice Kennedy, Justice Alito, Justice Thomas, Justice Gorsuch, all disagreed, said this was going to impede law enforcement efforts that are relied upon. There's also this notion of whether or not you really have an expectation of privacy. I think there are a lot of unanswered questions about how far the ruling goes. In other words, guys, what exact type of information are they going to be able to get off your phone without a search warrant? I think there'll be some questions to be resolved. But it's definitely a big decision because this is the type of information that prior to this decision, you could just get with a subpoena. And so that marks a big change.
Yeah, to your point, several have already called this to be one of the most groundbreaking cases in the area of technological privacy. Carolyn, some have said that we'll talk about the Fourth Amendment in terms of pre-Carpenter and post-Carpenter.
Yeah, I think there's some real basis to that. It really does move conceptually the Fourth Amendment into the sort of technological age we're in now, and recognizing that our conceptions of privacy and the way we share information and who we share it with really need to be reconsidered. You know, the third-party doctrine involved people who would give, you know, it would be like things like bank records. So you could, the government could get your bank records without a warrant because you didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in those records since you had shared that information with your bank. Now, that decision itself, I think, is certainly, even at the time, was open to debate. But that's been the law for a long time, and now we really have a shift where the court is willing to reconsider the fact, given the fact that we all share an enormous amount of information about ourselves just in order to function in the world, because we interact with everyone and everything through technology. And so the court is starting to think differently about what that means in terms of how we think about privacy. And you know, Justice Sotomayor a number of years ago actually wrote an opinion where she kind of predicted that that's what was going to have to happen.
All right, Carolyn.
You know, interesting guy. Just real quick.
Go ahead, Andy.
I mean, one thing to think about, like, at this point in time, text messages aren't kept that long by the different companies, but your text messages, they can get those with a subpoena. And when you think about it, people now use text message like they used to use phone calls. And usually to record phone calls, you either have to have one party consenting or you have to get a wiretap. And so I think that's another example of where we'll see where technology goes, to Carolyn's good point.
As we speak, Sam Panianiewicz is trying to delete every text he's sent over the years because he's incredibly concerned. But that's for another,
that's
for another day. Let's move on to the really interesting news. As if this wasn't already interesting enough 2 weeks in the Supreme Court, on Wednesday, we heard news that Justice Kennedy announced his retirement. Carolyn, you follow this obviously very closely for a living, as we all do, but how much of a surprise was this? I mean, this was speculated for a couple of years. You know, there were some signs in terms of, you know, Kennedy doing a couple things differently than he's done in the past with his clerks and reunions and things like that. All the same, though, it did come to as a surprise to a lot of us when he announced this on Wednesday.
Yeah, you know, rumor mill has had it for a couple of years that he really has wanted to retire, but that for a variety of reasons he felt that it wasn't the right time. I have to admit, you know, some people called it. They looked at some of the things that he had written in this last couple of weeks and sort of felt that, predicted that he might be leaving because he'd sort of given up on certain issues, like identifying a standard for partisan gerrymandering, for example, which he'd sort of held out as a possibility until now. But I personally was quite surprised because I thought that his concern about civility and the tone of the way we all interact in our country would prevent him from wanting to just fan the flames in this pretty hyper-polarized moment, which obviously his retirement is going to do, has already done.
Andy, you were a clerk at the Supreme Court, as was Carolyn. There's lots of talk now that Justice Kennedy was the swing vote. He represented the swing vote in many 5-4 decisions over the years. There's much discussion about who will take the place of that swing vote. Many are speculating that that will be Justice Roberts. He will move over into the swing vote camp. Let's break that down, because there are many who even feel that calling Kennedy a swing vote is inaccurate, that he was actually, you know, one of the reliable conservative votes. What are your thoughts on that, and who will fill that void going forward?
Sure. So I think that last observation is a good one. I mean, you know, even the year that I was fortunate enough to clerk, you had Lawrence versus Texas, which really laid the groundwork. As everyone will remember, it struck down the same-sex sodomy law under substantive due process in Texas and really laid the groundwork for Obergefell, you know, the case where we have same-sex marriage rights, you know, founded in the Constitution. In the same vein, you had the Michigan affirmative action cases where Justice Kennedy wrote a very strong dissent in the law school case and with really strong language condemning the law school program. So, you know, I think there are people on sort of both sides of the spectrum who they would say they'd find him frustrating. But I think on many, many issues, people are what people would say is a reliable conservative. I think there were certain issues, same-sex rights, the First Amendment, certain other issues where that wasn't the case. So I think that's a good observation.
I just second that. I completely agree with what Andy just said. I mean, he was a swing vote really only because the court itself has become so conservative. We have among the most conservative justices to ever serve on the court are currently on the bench. And so the court really moved around him. And should Chief Justice Roberts take on the sort of swing vote position, it will be for the same reason. Chief Justice Roberts is not a moderate. He's not going to become a moderate. He's a conservative. He has very strong ideological commitments. Those aren't going to change. So the swing vote is a description of somebody's position on what is already a very, very conservative court.
Right. I agree with that. And I also think, I know we've talked about this before, I do think he came in as a Chief Justice. I do think that being the Chief Justice can have somewhat of a moderating effect. I mean, I think if you look at Chief Justice Rehnquist, his opinions, you know, when they used to call him the lone dissenter, you had some pretty firebrand dissents. And as the Chief Justice, I do think that the Chief Justice is, and I would think that Roberts does to a certain extent, having been a Rehnquist clerk, does sort of think of himself as the shepherd of the institution to a certain extent.
Let's pick up on that concept, Andy, because it's really a fascinating one that I think is one of the most interesting, you know, looks into Supreme Court justice history, is the moderating effect that you have when you're on the court. You come in with one philosophy, and maybe that evolves. We saw that, for example, with, you know, Bush 41 appointed David Hackett Souter, who, you know, he thought would be a reliable conservative and ended up being a, you know, very moderate to liberal justice. Right now, Trump is talking about appointing a Kennedy replacement that will be a, you know, in the Scalia vein, will be on the court for, he said yesterday, you know, 40 or 45 years. Do you think times have evolved so that the Trump nominee, the Kennedy replacement, will be a reliable conservative? Or is there a chance that person will evolve, you know, over the course of a potential 40-year term? Let's have both of you weigh in. We'll start with Andy on that.
Sure. I mean, it'll be really interesting. As you guys know, just for some background to your listeners, the president put out a very politically savvy list, right? He was trying to shore up those conservatives who were maybe not showing up at his rallies, but were people who he wanted to energize. He put out this list of 25 candidates, if you remember, that the Federal Society signed off on, and that was very important to a lot of people.
Well, they actually drafted it, really, right? I mean, let's call it what it is. They drafted it. He signed off on it. But go ahead.
Okay, but and if you look at that, it looks like, you know, it touches many of the important battleground states, you know, Florida, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Colorado. I wrote these out. Minnesota, Missouri. You know, all these different folks. There are a number of people on there, again, who are considered, you know, darlings of the conservative side. Like you would have the judge out of Alabama, Judge Pryor. But it's hard to say. I mean, I think that, you know, as early as this week or as late as this week, or President Trump said it would be somebody from that list. If it is, there are a number of people who are considered, you know, rock solid conservatives. You have Mike Lee from Utah. Like I said, you have Judge Pryor. So I think it is likely going to be someone that, you know, from this list, conservatives will be very happy with. But I think anyone's guess is as good as anyone else's at this point.
Now, Carolyn, what do you think? It's fairly impossible to predict if these judges will evolve over time. But given the conservative makeup of this list of 25, do you think it's likely that they will evolve over time?
I think it's very unlikely that they'll become more moderate over time. The, you know, one of the things that's happened in the years since the Souter appointment is that these conservative organizations have worked really hard to sort of figure out what went wrong in their mind with Justice Souter, and they have an extremely you know, well honed sort of infrastructure for identifying talent early on from the time people are in law school. Helping people build a strong resume, good credentials, and really sort of funneling them into the mix of becoming judges and maybe eventually a Supreme Court justice. Sort of to be in that milieu means that you've been part of this conservative infrastructure for basically your entire legal career. And it seems very unlikely to me that somebody would come from there and surprise people in any significant way.
Give us some insight. You both worked at the Supreme Court when Justice Kennedy served. I understand you didn't work directly with Justice Kennedy. Carolyn, you clerked for Justice Breyer. Andy, you clerked for Justice Rehnquist. How much interaction, though, do you have with a Justice Kennedy, and what insights do you have for our listeners about what kind of judge and what kind of man he was?
Well, I didn't at least have much personal interaction with Justice Kennedy. Certainly saw him, had, I think a couple of groups of law clerks had coffee with him one day. But he, you know, he took his job pretty seriously. I think when I was there, he was not the swing justice the way he became after Justice O'Connor's retirement. She was much more, in that role. But it was pretty clear that he was not unhappy to find himself, would not have been unhappy to find himself in the position of being able to make these pretty significant decisions.
Yeah, and I think I agree. I think he worked extremely hard. I know some of his law clerks from, you know, from my year and then other years, and they all worked extremely hard and had a lot of conversations with him about the cases. Like Carolyn, I didn't have a tremendous amount of personal interaction with him, but I do. We went to a Baltimore Orioles game, and he and Justice Thomas rode on the little minibus with us, and he was pleasant and funny and you know, very social, very kind. I know his law clerks speak very well of him. He cares about them. He knows, you know, their kids' names, things like that. And you know, when you talk before about the surprise, it's always surprising, but you know, he is 81. He's a guy. We're the weaker sex. I mean, 81's old for a guy, and it's a very demanding job, especially for someone who takes it so seriously, and it can be all-consuming, you know, and I think we forget sometimes there are people with kids and grandkids and, you know, want to go to ball games, want to do things, and, you know, so it's not entirely surprising either that, you know, he maybe wants some more of his time, of his life at this point to himself and his family.
All right, last question. We'll let you go. We always like availing ourselves of your experience working at the Supreme Court. Take us inside those last couple of days. I mean, they obviously leave the most important cases to the end of the term. What are those last few days of a term like? And what's the last day like? Is there a big party? Do you go out? You know, what, or does everyone scatter? Take us inside those last few days if you can.
Well,
I assume they're very incredibly busy, right? But after you're done, is there a great sense of relief?
There's an enormous sense of relief. I mean, it's been like running a marathon. A lot of the justices just leave town right away.
Yeah. It was fun, though. There at the end of the year, guys, there's this internal court personnel only skit. And you have one clerk from each chambers imitate their justice. I had to be Chief Justice Rehnquist. And it's a little nerve-wracking, but when I was there, Justice Scalia was there, and you'd give these big, loud belly laughs at the jokes. And they would kind of poke fun at the year. And we had some controversial cases. We had the three strikes cases. We had Lawrence versus Texas. We had the affirmative action cases. And tensions ran high, especially among the young clerks who were full of piss and wind on both sides, who think, you know, this is their time. And so it was a good way to let off some steam. But I can completely agree with Caroline. I remember when we finally finished, like, the last dissent we were working on or the last majority opinion, I think I slept for, like, felt like I slept for, like, 3 days straight, you know, before doing anything else.
We need video, by the way, of both of you acting in those skits. That I would pay money for that.
No recording allowed.
No recording.
Yeah.
Great stuff. That's Andy DeVoe, partner at Loeb & Loeb, and Carolyn Shapiro, the associate professor of law at Chicago Kent College of Law. Check out the blog, too. You can Google iSCOTUS now. It's a Chicago Kent blog. She's also the co-director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States. Thank you both. We know we'll do it again soon.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks very much.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit DLAPiper.com.
Rolling along on Legal Face-Off on WGN at WGNRadio.com. Rich Linkoff, David Sussler. My name is Sam Panionovich. Joining us now on the phones, Miley Smith, the staff attorney at IllinoisPolicy.org, to take a deeper dive into the Janus case. Miley is the staff attorney at the Illinois Policy Institute. Hi, Miley. Welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Miley, give us a brief overview of Janus and why it was so significant.
Well, Janus was brought by Mark Janus, who is a state employee here in Illinois. And his argument was very simple. This case was about fairness and First Amendment freedom. People shouldn't be forced to give up their rights of speech because they choose to be public servants. And the Supreme Court agreed. It ruled that forced union fees violate free speech. So to force government workers to pay fees to a union is a constitutional violation.
Now, Miley, this case has been attempted to be brought before in prior years. Why was now the right time in terms of what's going on in not just Illinois politics, but nationally? And why was this the right Supreme Court makeup to finally result in this decision?
Well, the Supreme Court certainly has been signaling for years that this is the direction that it was heading. And in at least three other cases, it has indicated that it was ready to overrule prior precedent that allowed these forced union fees. But either because that question wasn't directly before the courts, or in the case of the Friedrichs case, Justice Scalia passed away before the case was decided, the timing just didn't work out. But at this point in time, there were five justices who were ready to look at Abood and overturn that prior precedent.
So here in Illinois, Bruce Rauner obviously was a key backer of this action. He has now been, of course, all over, you know, media talking about what a victory this was. How do you think this affects him personally and his campaign? We all know that he is facing a campaign battle for the gubernatorial election here in November. How do you think this will play out locally?
Well, for those workers who are ready for this newly restored freedom, I think that he's going to be a champion for them. What we do know is that the unions have always been, it's government unions, inherently political. They pour millions of dollars into politics, particularly in election years. So I think we're going to be seeing more of that, or more of the same, in this election cycle.
So, Miley, where do you think public or government unions go from here?
You know, this is a case where the immediate impact is going to be on those individual workers. If they are interested in this newly restored freedom, you know, what we are encouraging them to do is go ahead and let their union know they want to opt out, let their employer know to stop those fees. But in terms of long-term impact for the unions themselves, this doesn't have the effect that I think a lot of people think that it will have. They still maintain most of their, you know, basically all of their power here in Illinois to negotiate, to go on strike. What I do think will happen is that this is going to encourage the unions to listen more to their workers and be more consumer-based and do what their workers want them to do.
Miley, to that point, you know, there have been several opponents to this decision that have been vocal. Of course, as you could expect, the CTU, Chicago Teachers Union, has blasted it. Mayor Rahm Emanuel released a statement talking about this decision upending decades of precedent and progress for working families. I know that your organization was a proponent of this decision, is a proponent. How do you answer those critics of what the Supreme Court decided this week?
The court clearly placed the First Amendment and First Amendment speech of workers above what union leaders want. That's what we're seeing. The union leadership has not been paying attention to their workers. Like I already mentioned, they're incredibly political. In fact, if you look at AFSCME's spending and the National Education Association spending, they frequently spend more on politics than they do on representing their workers. So this decision is really restoring more of a balance between the rank and file and the leadership who has been running rampant with their political agenda.
Miley, we'll wrap up with a question about the Supreme Court vacancy that was announced 2 days ago with Justice Kennedy retiring. We're asking all of our guests today, as this is a Supreme Court focused show, you are admitted to practice before the U.S. Supreme Court. You have also appeared in publications, including SCOTUS blog. What are your feelings on this vacancy? And do you have any thoughts on early candidates for Kennedy's replacement?
No, I think everyone thought that this was probably coming. And in terms of a replacement, you know, I speak on behalf of myself, not necessarily Illinois policy, but I have had interactions with a couple of the candidates, Patrick Weirich, who's on the Supreme Court in Oklahoma, Judge Gruender on the Eighth Circuit. They are both people that I admire very much. It certainly looks like a rock solid list, so I'm not sure that the president can go wrong with this list.
Are there any... I think there might be one or two on the 25 or 26 person list from Illinois, or am I mistaken? Are there any local judges who are on that list? Do you know?
You know, I'm not aware of any locals.
Got it.
No.
That's Miley Smith. She's the staff attorney at the Illinois Policy Institute. To learn more, illinoispolicy.org. Thank you, Miley.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
We continue on Legal Face-Off. Joining us now, the National Legal Director of the ACLU, ACLU.org. His name is David Cole, and he also wrote an op-piece in the Washington Post. I represented the wedding cake couple. We lost a battle but won the war. David joins us now on Legal Face-Off. Hello, David. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, David, this is quite a get for our legal show here, so we appreciate it. You argued the Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission case before the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, from your perspective, you lost, as Sam mentioned. Tell us first and foremost what that experience was like, given especially the amount of press and notoriety around this particular case.
Yeah, well, it's always an incredible experience to argue before the Supreme Court. You know, there's nothing that you are more prepared for. I did five practice arguments before going in there. I had an incredible team, and I felt, you know, it felt like a good argument. It's hard to tell from argument how the court's going to resolve the case, but in this case, actually, I think you probably could have drawn a pretty direct line from the argument to the result.
Yeah, and you've argued many cases before the Supreme Court, we should mention, including Texas versus Johnson in the United States, which is an important First Amendment case. So this is not your first time, but this one obviously did have a lot of notoriety. So let's go through the decision that was issued last Monday. Talk to us about how confident, first of all, you felt after the argument and how you felt when you received the decision.
So I think neither side could feel confident after the argument because on the one hand, the court showed virtually no appetite for the argument that the United States as amicus and the Baker were arguing. They were contending that because the Baker has a Christian faith objection to same-sex marriage, he gets an out from a neutral non-discrimination law that requires all businesses open to the public to serve all people. And the court was clearly not buying that argument. At the same time, Justice Kennedy expressed particular concern about a statement made by one of the Colorado Civil Rights Commissioners at a low level in the adjudication of this case, which he considered to be intolerant of religion. What the commissioner said was, she said she finds it despicable when people invoke religion to harm other people. And at the end of the day, what the court did was write a decision in which they did not actually formally decide whether the Baker, you know, violated the gay couple's rights, but said in very strong terms that there is no basis for a religious objection to avoiding a non-discrimination law, but then found that because of this commissioner's asserted bias, they had to rule for the Baker.
So did they punt? I mean, did the Supreme Court lose an opportunity or purposely avoid an opportunity to deal with the underlying issue dealing with civil rights of same-sex individuals and rule this case on a very narrow basis? And if so, the follow-up question obviously is, will they in the future? And not to ask an even more compound question, but how will the Kennedy vacancy affect this case if it comes up in the future? There's three questions, and I apologize for that.
So they clearly decided not to decide. They did not take up this case to slap the hand of a low level civil rights commissioner in Colorado. That's not the kind of thing the Supreme Court takes up. The Supreme Court took up this case to decide the basic question of whether you can assert a First Amendment right to discriminate. And I think at the end of the day, they didn't decide that question. They put that off in a formal sense, but in a 7-2 decision, they wrote very strong language, making quite clear that they are not going to recognize a First Amendment right to discriminate. I mean, in addition to saying that philosophical and religious objections do not allow businesses to avoid complying with non-discrimination laws, which was exactly the Baker's argument here, they also said it would be unacceptable because if you recognized such an exception, then businesses across this country could put up signs in their windows saying, we don't serve gays and lesbians, we don't serve women, we don't serve Muslims, we don't serve Jews, and assert that they have a First Amendment objection to doing those things. So I think, when this case ultimately comes back, this issue ultimately comes back to the court, if it ever does, I'm very confident we will win. We've won in every lower court. We have won this argument. And so when they took it up, there was real concern that, well, why would they take it up if all the courts had gone the same way except to reverse? And importantly, they did not reverse. And only Justice Thomas adopted the position, anything like what the Baker and the Trump administration were asserting.
That's fascinating stuff. David, you have litigated many cases, as we mentioned, before the Supreme Court. I was recently admitted to the Supreme Court, and for me, the ceremony was incredible. Being in the Supreme Court with the justices was just incredibly humbling and just awe-inspiring, and Justice Ginsburg came back and greeted us. It was all incredible. At this point, you are the, incredibly accomplished, obviously, National Legal Director of the ACLU. You've argued these cases before the Supreme Court. Does it become old hat? I'm always curious for people who are in your position, or is it still, when you walk in on this case, do you still pinch yourself and think, wow, look where I am and look what I'm doing?
Oh, it never becomes old hat. Absolutely. It's the ultimate, legal courtroom in the country. And it's an incredible experience because you are as prepared as you possibly could be. And the court is, always incredibly well prepared. And as you saw from being in the courtroom, it's on the one hand, this grand courtroom with the big columns, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, the justices are right there, very close to you, almost arm's length. And it's really a conversation that goes on. It's a conversation between, 9 or 10 people, but it's a conversation. So the combination of kind of the intimate setting and the grandeur and the authority is just a remarkable thing. And I think it's a very civil process. And something we ought to be proud of, particularly in this day and age when so much of what the government does is not particularly civil.
How much do you think politics and social media play into these decisions? Obviously, when you walked into court that day, there were people literally standing on both sides of the Supreme Court, the exterior, protesting either side of this case. I mean, this case engendered, understandably, as much emotion as any case we've seen recently. I know the justices will tell you that that doesn't play into their decision making, but how much does that vibe sort of permeate what you're doing that day and generally the atmosphere of these kind of cases?
So I think the court, knows when it's deciding a controversial case, and I think that enters into the way in which they may resolve it. So, for example, in this case, I think it's, one reading of what they did was they tried to be statesmanlike. This was probably the most contentious case of the term, with the exception of Janus. And instead of deciding it on a 5-4 basis, They reached a 7-2 cross-party line result, and they gave something sort of to both sides. They gave the Baker a win, but a very narrow win. They gave us very strong language that this kind of First Amendment right to discriminate is not going to be recognized, and sent a signal to the lower courts that the lower courts are essentially doing the right thing. But by not clearly and definitively resolving it, they put off a final resolution for a couple more years. When, again, you know, as time goes on, this issue will become less and less controversial, in the same way that, you know, no one would say that a baker could refuse to bake a cake for a mixed race couple today. Back in the 60s, you know, there was a real question whether states could prohibit mixed race weddings. But today they're fully accepted, and same-sex marriages have also gone from being unthinkable to being broadly accepted. And I think the court recognizes that trend and may well have thought that this was a statesmanlike decision that allows the issue to continue to percolate, gives something to both sides, but makes it clear they're not going to recognize a First Amendment opt-out from anti-discrimination laws.
Do you think that with the coming vacancy left by Justice Kennedy and a new appointee, do you think that might change the balance of the thinking of the court, and maybe the court goes in a different direction from what you just described?
So I think, you know, the replacement of Justice Kennedy is one of the most important issues that any of us can consider and take on. And I mean, he really made the court a mainstream court because he had an open mind, because he believed in an evolving constitution, because he sometimes voted with the conservatives and sometimes voted with the liberals and was open to persuasion. He kept that court in the middle. If the next justice, Justice Kennedy's replacement, is a rigid right-wing conservative, like Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, then the court is going to veer sharply to the right, and far to the right of where the country is. And that's not a good place for the court to be. I think on this question, I'm confident that on this question we would win even under that court, because I just think it's untenable, and I think some of the conservatives recognize it's untenable to say that neutral laws, like a public accommodations law that just says a business once it chooses to be open to all, has to serve everyone without discriminating, it's untenable to say, well, yeah, but if you can assert a First Amendment speech objection and your business is expressive, you get an out, which is what the government and the Baker were arguing. It's untenable because virtually all human activity is expressive in one way or another. And so it's not a cabinable, it's not a limited exemption. It's a glaring, gaping loophole. And so I just don't think there's any appetite on the court to recognize that, and I don't think there will be after Justice Kennedy's replacement. But on other issues of LGBT equality, on issues of women's rights and abortion in particular, on issues of our protection from establishment of religion, on affirmative action, you know, those are all issues where, you know, the current law stands on a kind of one vote balance, and that vote was Justice Kennedy's. So when he goes, so many of those issues could go the other way.
That's David Cole, the National Legal Director of the ACLU, ACLU.org. David, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Joining us on the phones now, Jordan M. Goodman, who's an attorney at Horwood, Marcus & Burke. He's also the co-chair of the firm's State and Local Tax Group. And Jordan joins us to talk about the latest ruling with the sales tax, collecting sales taxes. Jordan, welcome to Legal Faceoff.
Thank you very much for having me. Interesting times for us.
It is. And Jordan, usually I'll say on Legal Faceoff, we don't cover tax law too much, but this is a case that is important because it actually affects us all directly in the pocketbook. Explain why.
Well, it is most of the remote sellers that we deal with today, the online sellers, generally don't collect tax if they don't have a store or some kind of physical presence in the state. Now, under this new ruling, it looks like almost all of them will be collecting tax. So our bills on things we buy online will be going up.
So this was a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court. First of all, tell us, you know, what the basis of the decision was, and also explain that you and your firm were involved in a case that is associated with this one. Explain all that for us, please.
Sure. So it's back in the '90s. This actually started as a catalog type question back before we had online or an internet. It was catalog question of whether catalogs being sent to the state would generate an obligation to collect tax. We were successful in a case called Quill v. North Dakota back in 1992, sustaining a 1967 decision that held the same thing. Since that time, since 1992, Congress has tried to pass laws to set some de minimis standards so smaller sellers, smaller catalog sellers wouldn't have this obligation, but putting the burden on everybody else. With the increase in e-commerce, online sellers, there's been tremendous pressure on Congress, budgetary concerns at the state level, lots of pressure to do it. South Dakota passed a law that established its own de minimis standards, 200 transactions or $100,000. So you can be a remote seller, let's just talk about online sellers, with no contact in South Dakota, but if you made more than 200 sales into the state or had over $100,000 of transactions into the state, of sales into the state, you now have to collect use tax from your customers. Now, I do have to clarify one thing. The tax has always been due. If I buy something online and it's not collected for me in Illinois, I always owe tax. But the compliance of people self-reporting is somewhere about 10%. And that's why the states were losing out on this revenue. If the out-of-state collector doesn't collect it and the in-state buyer doesn't pay it voluntarily to the state does not collect sales tax on it.
So I have a question. You raised a point about the de minimis sellers, which I find interesting. If the brick-and-mortar small shops with maybe less than $100,000 or $200,000 of business in a year, they have to collect the tax. Why is it an unfair burden to an online seller to collect that tax? Why not assess the burden to collect taxes across the board?
And that actually was the focus of Justice Kennedy's decision in this case. It said in a long time ago, it was found that there would be a burden put on out-of-state sellers because they didn't get the benefits the state gave them. They weren't. So if I have a small store, I get police protection, I get fire protection, I have streets to drive on, and customers have parking lots, things that they get from an in-state presence that an out-of-state seller didn't benefit. And the question was it too big a burden on the outside seller? What's most interesting about this and what the court really said is that we made the wrong decision back in 1967. We confirmed the wrong decision in 1992. This never should have been the standard, and they rectified it here rather than waiting for Congress to come in and pass a law to do it. So you're 100% correct. And Justice Kennedy said it's unfair to be a remote seller now. You got such an advantage of not having to collect tax versus the local store, the mom-and-pop store located in the state.
So now we've got this new rule that online sellers have to collect and pay sales tax. How do states enforce that?
Well, through the audit process, just as they would for any out-of-state company, the Departments of Revenue in the various states have the ability to send them audit requests, to look at their books and records, to issue an assessment, and then if found to be owing the tax, to collect it just as you would any other obligation for an out-of-state company. So, you know, they can send them a bill, and if they don't pay it, they can try to seize their assets located in the state via a bank account or some other property that they own, or they could try to enforce it in the home state of the out-of-state seller. And that's, you know, so there's ways to do that, and it's not an inexpensive way to do it, but the states have ratcheted up their ability to do it, and, you know, if you have a bank account anywhere, and it's a national bank, there is an ability to get your funds in the bank to pay the bill. So
a lot of new civil procedure litigation and long-arm jurisdiction litigations coming down the pike.
Which Sussler loves, by the way. Nothing excites Sussler more than long-arm.
Civil procedure was one of my favorite classes first year of law school.
No, and this is going to be the biggest boom for the software industry, tax software industry, that I think that we've ever seen. Everybody's going to need to comply. There's thousands of different, you know, billing systems, and they're going to have to be adapted to a kind of a uniform way of collecting and keeping track of it. One of the arguments that the out-of-state sellers had is there's over 10,000 taxing jurisdictions in this country. And each one can impose a different rate, and you have to figure out what's being sold, what the rate is, and you and your neighbor may have different rates depending upon where you live in a taxing jurisdiction. So it's not an easy burden, and that's one of the questions of why this has been sustained for such a long time.
That's Jordan Goodman, attorney from Horwood, Marcus & Burke, hmblaw.com, to learn more. Thank you, Jordan. Appreciate the time.
Thanks, guys.
We continue the conversation now on Legal Faceoff. You can always find us on Facebook, Twitter, even iTunes. Search for Legal Faceoff WGN. And joining us now, she's in studio, a partner at Immigration Attorneys LLP, the website immattylp.com. She is Shannon Shepherd. Hi, Shannon. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Shannon, lots of breaking news, obviously, involving immigration policy, not limited to the Trump travel ban decision that we just talked about a little bit, but we'll take a little bit of a deeper dive into. So what is your reaction to the Supreme Court's decision on that issue this week?
Well, I think it was a terrible decision. I think it's going to end up being on the wrong side of history. The dissent from Justice Sotomayor, I think, says it all. It was just a thinly veiled discriminatory policy that the government really didn't offer any proof that that these policies would make us safer. There's no evidence that it will prevent any infiltration or terrorists, and there's no basis for separating families and keeping otherwise productive members of society out of the U.S.
It seems like the majority tried to argue narrowly that this was more of a question of authority, presidential authority, and whether the president has the exclusive ability to decide issues of national security, including immigration policy. Whereas, as you mentioned, the dissent said, no, this was clearly a function of Trump wanting to keep people out because of their religion. And they pointed to his tweets and his statements on the campaign trail that this was a Muslim ban. You're not buying the argument of the majority, though.
No, not at all. I think it was really interesting how they mentioned the tweets and the statements that the president made, actually saying he wanted to ban Muslims from coming into the United States.
And they, in fact, were negative about that. They acknowledged that that was not, I mean, Kennedy especially said, this is not the way people should talk, basically.
Yeah, exactly. But then they completely disregarded all of those things and just looked at the plain language of the executive order, which, of course, doesn't say this is a Muslim ban. It says, you know, we need to do extreme vetting and these countries don't provide enough security. But they offered no evidence that that's the case. And just completely ignored the clear intent that the president has expressed consistently from day one of his campaign.
All right. So bring our listeners up to speed now on the current state of immigration policy, because it's been a confusing, you know, few weeks or few days, because, initially Trump and Jeff Sessions announced that they would be separating parents from their children. Then the director of Homeland Security said that, you know, we don't have the ability to change that. Only Congress has that ability. A few days later, Trump reversed course in the face of incredible public pressure and said we will no longer be separating these families, but we will continue our zero tolerance policy. So help our listeners out. Where are we currently with immigration policy from the White House down?
Well, this was a crisis that was created by the president and by Jeff Sessions. There is no law that requires separation of families. There's no law that requires detention of people seeking asylum. And I think that's really important for people to understand that there is a law that says if you come to the United States and you express a fear of returning to your home country, you get what's called a credible fear screening. And if the officer who does the interview, finds that there is a credible fear, then you have the right to have your case heard by an immigration judge. There's nothing in that law that requires that the person remain detained. There's nothing that requires them to be prosecuted for attempted illegal entry because they've now complied with the law and expressed their intent to apply for asylum. It's also the executive order that was signed that at first they said they couldn't sign because only Congress could change it. Basically trades family separation with family detention. And again, there's no law requiring that. And studies have shown that it's actually really harmful emotionally and physically for children being detained for long periods. So
that was supported by the judge yesterday, who we saw the young lady from Brazil reunited with her 9-year-old son. And the judge cited to the psychological damage that this kind of separation results in.
Yes. When you've got multiple medical associations, pediatric associations, psychological associations coming up with detailed explanations of why this is harmful, that's something that the administration needs to listen to.
So I have a question on the practical side of this, though. Now that the official position of the government is, well, let's not separate the families anymore, but we've got thousands of kids who are separated from their parents, how do they really reunite them? Does the government have the means to do that? Especially, my understanding is the parents who may be prosecuted for illegally crossing the border are in a different government agency than the children who are being held. And those government agencies have difficulty communicating and exchanging information. So how do we accomplish the reunification in the real world?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? The government does not have a plan in place. They never had a plan in place. And you're right. When the families are separated, the children go into the Department of Health and Human Services and the Office of Refugee Resettlement, whereas the parents are detained in criminal facilities. And there's just no mechanism that was set up for them to communicate to each other. We don't know what kind of records they took of whose child was going where and how they were going to keep track of that. Frankly, I don't think they did. And so now it's going to be a nightmare trying to reunite all these families that have been so brutally separated.
Shannon, last question. From my perspective, this is consistent with a troubling theme that we've seen out of this administration, which is demonizing minorities and foreigners and people who aren't necessarily the same people that voted for Trump. How do you feel about that, and what are you doing to maybe stem that tide that seems to be growing as we speak?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely part of a broader, more insidious plan of or policy of the administration. We call it, some of it is the invisible wall. So that's the travel ban. There's not a physical wall there, but they're trying to ban certain people of certain religions from coming out from coming in to the United States. They're targeting people who are filing for asylum. They're targeting Central American, Hispanic, Latino, basically any minority ethnicity. And it's
as basic as using terms like vermin and infiltration. I mean, how much more direct do you have to be? I don't think we've seen attitudes like that since, you know, the World War II.
It does. It rings back to Nazi Germany, frankly. And there's the Department of Homeland Security actually posted on their website today a press release, I guess, saying that, you know, we must build the wall to keep America safe again. And it just rings of the, you know, protect our own and keep everybody else out. And it's really unfortunate and scary, frankly.
That's Shannon Shepherd, partner of Immigration Attorneys LLP. Shannon, thanks for coming in. We'll have to do this again soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Legal grab bag time, as we always end the show. Legal Face Off, Rich and David. My name is Sam and Ben Anderson. Great job behind the glass, chopping it up. We'll start with one of seven topics, the Quintonial DeGreer verdict. Rich, what do we got?
Yeah, this week the verdict came down. Lots were watching it. This was in Cook County here in Chicago. Quintonial DeGreer was shot by a Chicago police officer named Robert Rialmo, and his family sued the officer, and the jury came back after a very high-profile trial, as I mentioned. The jury came back and found that the police officer unjustifiably shot and killed Quintonial DeGreer, and they awarded the family $1 million. Well, a few minutes afterwards, the judge basically wiped out that verdict because the jurors, in addition to awarding the $1 million in damages, said that in a special interrogatory, which is just basically a form, they said that Rialmo fired in the reasonable belief that DeGreer posed the danger of death or great bodily harm, which are completely inconsistent. So on the one hand, they said that he was responsible for the shooting. On the other hand, they said it was a justifiable shooting because he was scared for his life. So within minutes of this verdict being announced, it was wiped out. So, you know, kind of unusual, but that's the jury system. That's why, you know, you've got 12 people deciding these things. They really didn't get it right because they found completely inconsistent things. But, got lots of attention this week.
Looking at a case involving Buzz Aldrin, the former astronaut, David, he's suing his children.
Yeah, this is kind of a sad story, I think. Apparently two of Buzz's children think that he is suffering from increased confusion and memory loss and have taken steps to take control of all of his assets. Buzz thinks that they are just trying to take advantage of him as a form of elder abuse, and he filed a lawsuit against his children. Buzz says he is more alive and more energetic and less confused than he ever has been in his life. His children say they're concerned about things like his increasingly lavish lifestyle, such as spending more than $70,000 a month.
$70,000 a month. He only earns $36,000 a year.
Yeah. So, you know, this is...
That's Sam Panyanovich spending right there.
You know, and it shows sort of as the baby boomers are aging, the population over 60, I think, is currently the largest segment of our population. And there's questions. When is it time for your kids to take care of you? And when do you have to realize, well, maybe I'm not making the best decisions of my own? Or, hey, yeah, I'm 88, but I'm still of sound mind and body. It's tough. My biggest question is I've read this story in the Washington Post. There's a great photograph of Buzz Aldrin wearing both a bow tie and a necktie.
That to me is litigation worthy in and of itself. I would sue him for the fashion faux pas of bow tie and necktie. But yeah, it's similar to other stories we've covered. I mean, Sam, you remember the Casey Kasem lawsuit that was very similar. Casey Kasem, of course, one of our inspirations here on Legal Face Off. But hey, some quick Buzz Aldrin trivia. Who knows what cartoon character Buzz Aldrin inspired? Sam, maybe you know this because we talked about it earlier.
Buzz Lightyear.
Buzz Lightyear, of course. Here's one you don't know. In addition to being most well known for being the second man to walk on the moon, Buzz Aldrin was actually the first to urinate on the moon. Now, I read that. I wasn't sure if it meant urinate while on the moon or literally urinate on the surface of the moon. So, Sam, check that out for us.
A self-contained spacesuit.
I would imagine. Yeah, I would imagine it was within the spacesuit, right? I mean, it would have been probably dangerous to do his business outside of the spacesuit. But in any case, we move on to another story, Sam.
That involves
less moon urine than the prior story.
Sterling Brown, Bucks guard forward against the Milwaukee Police. Another development, David. What do we got?
This, to me, is really a horrific story. Sterling Brown, late one night, early one morning, happened to park his car illegally across two or three handicap parking spots. So a Milwaukee police officer stopped him for it, and while Sterling stood there respectfully with his hands in his pockets, the police officer called in backup. Six more police officers came very quickly, quickly surrounded him. A rather peaceful conversation ensued, and all of a sudden, one of the police officers just took him to the ground. Somebody yelled, "Taser, taser, taser," and they tasered him. All over police stop. The Milwaukee Police Department has already found that the police involved acted inappropriately and led to a short suspension for three of the officers. Sterling Brown has sued the Milwaukee Police Department and the individual officers, alleging it's a clear case of race discrimination. Raises all sorts of issues, but you know, the statistics show that people of color, black and brown people especially, are by a large percentage the victims of police violence over Caucasian people. And the real thing here is a question of racial bias and how this shows itself by police officers.
Rich, we've got some news involving Heather Locklear. She was reportedly overdosed after her recent arrest. That is her second arrest in 4 months, and now she's in the hospital. What do we know?
Yeah, Heather Locklear, of course, famous for many 90s shows that Sam loved, like T.J. Hooker, Dynasty. I know David Sussler is a big Dynasty fan. She's had some hard times. She, as you mentioned, was arrested. She's been in and out of rehab since 2016. I think this was her fifth rehab stint. But in February of this year, she was involved in some domestic abuse issues with her husband. She was taken into custody. She was eventually released. And then in June, as you mentioned, police responded to a 911 call about a domestic incident at her house. She was intoxicated, arguing with her boyfriend. It was necessary to remove her from the home. So, yeah, unfortunate news with Heather Locklear, who, by the way, was featured prominently on the wall of a young Rich Lenkov back in the day. I had a Heather Locklear poster. Sussler?
I like how you tried to throw it at me, and then you assumed responsibility.
Heather Locklear and the other Heather. Let me see. Back in the day, back in the 80s, there was two Heathers. There was Heather Locklear, who was on many young boys' walls, but also... Can you name the other one? Sussler? Ben?
I'm Sam? On a blank.
Heather Thomas. Heather Thomas from The Fall Guy. Just drawing crickets on that one. Yeah, trust me. Google.
I'm thinking of Heather Springsteen posters that were walls,
yes,
when I was in high school.
Google Heather Thomas poster. You'll see what I mean. But we move on, Sam, from the Heather Locklear story to what? What's our next?
Eric Kramer, former Bears quarterback, in trouble again, this time not self-inflicted. He's been accused of domestic violence. Remember, Kramer did try and take his own life in 2015 and failed.
Yeah, 53 years old, released on bond this week. Police said he was cooperative after his wife obtained a restraining order, looking to extend it because she fears that he's on a, quote, manhunt to end her life. She's filed for divorce, as you can imagine. She's claimed that he approached her following an argument, lost his temper, swore at her, threw items at her, including a knife block, and then began smashing other objects. This is on the heels of, as you mentioned, a attempted suicide in 2015, in which he actually shot himself, but he survived a gunshot wound to the head. So, yeah, rough times for the former Bear quarterback.
Staying in sports, Kevin Ollie, former Bulls guard, and then you also have the former head coach at UConn. He is threatening a lawsuit against his former school.
Yeah, Kevin Ollie, who just won a national championship with UConn a couple years ago, is now at odds with UConn. They fired him in March. They pointed to several NCAA violations that he called minor, and now he is countersued, saying that they inappropriately fired him and are defaming him and all sorts of things. But yeah, a quick fall from a guy who had a really promising career in the NCAA. Sam, thoughts on Kevin Ollie? You've covered basketball. Is he done as a coach?
Oh, yeah, he's done. He's cooked. He won't get another job. And he won that championship. Remember, he won that championship with Jim Calhoun's players.
Correct.
So he was never able to really keep it together at UConn, and that's why he's out. Remember, when they fired him, too, they didn't give him a reason, and then all this is starting to flow out. So we'll keep you posted on that. And then the last part of the legal grab bag, David and Rich, the ice cream lawsuit. What is an ice cream lawsuit? What do we know?
Underfilled ice cream. Halo Top, which is an ice cream company, has been sued alleging, and this is a 13-page complaint that was filed against Eden Creamery LLC, accusing Halo Top of swindling the American customer because they have routinely underfilled, and dramatically so at times, the pints of ice cream that they sell. And this, of course, has resulted in incredible damages to the plaintiffs. We've covered these type of class actions in the past, cases involving potato chip bags that are underfilled and so forth. There was a Subway sandwich lawsuit. Subway. Yeah, exactly. So good use of the courts. Yeah, David?
Oh, yeah. It's got to make you proud, right? Right.
Sam, do you get upset when you open your Halo Top and there's not quite the amount of pistachio that you thought you were purchasing?
Well, I don't eat Halo Top, for the record. And that ice cream, isn't that a low-calorie ice cream anyway? So shouldn't you be happy that there's not enough ice cream in there? If you're going to buy Halo Top, you don't want it.
That's why it's because it's half full.
I open a bag of potato chips, and the chips are halfway gone already when I open them. That's what ticks me off.
Absolutely. All that air.
Buy a smaller bag.
Yeah, buy a smaller bag, exactly. Or if you just crunch all the chips up with your hand, you get more chips.
There you go.
Do that, too. David, what'd you think of your captain's seat today, sitting in the co-pilot seat?
Sussler's maiden voyage here on Legal Faceoff.
You know, I honestly, I'm a fan of the show, and I listen to the podcast every week. The morning after it posts, I listen to it on my drive to work, and I have to admit, sometimes I forgot I was supposed to ask questions because I'm just listening and learning. But it was fun.
Well, hurry back, Tina Martini. We loved having Sussler, but we missed as that awkward pause indicated.
I don't think her job is in danger here.
Very good. No Wally Pip here.
No Wally.
For Rich and David, my name is Sam, and for Ben Anderson, thank you for listening to Legal Faceoff. You can always find more at WGNradio.com. Search for Legal Faceoff on iTunes. We'll talk to you next time.